and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the bipartisan report from the Senate Intelligence Committee analyzing the scope and impact of Russian influence over the 2016 campaign via their use and weaponization of U.S. social media platforms such as YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook. David Carroll, a professor of media design at the New School, whose analysis examines major shifts in the media as it relates to advertising, surveillance, social media, and journalism, joins us to discuss the findings in two reports, one by Oxford University's Computational Propaganda Project and another by New Knowledge, a firm that tracks online disinformation. Focusing on the latter, we will look into how the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, owned by Putin's chef Yevgeny Prigozhin, used social media to target right-wing Americans promoting Donald Trump's candidacy while targeting left-wing Americans and African Americans with anti-Hillary Clinton propaganda, urging them not to vote or to vote for the Green Party's Jill Stein. The Oxford report criticizes technology companies for their, quote, belated and uncoordinated response, while the New Knowledge report criticizes the Silicon Valley tech giants for not being forthcoming and misleading the American people by playing down the Russian influence campaign, which has been underestimated and was far more effective, having reached 126 million people on Facebook and 20 million more on Instagram. Then, with a U.S. district judge in Texas ruling the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional on Friday night, just before Saturday's enrollment deadline, we will try to understand why President Trump is celebrating the move to deny 20 million Americans health care and assess the legal justification with Egan Kemp, the healthcare policy advocate for Public Citizen. He joins us to argue that the president's and the Republicans' unrelenting efforts to deny Americans, particularly those with pre-existing conditions, health care, is why a recent poll found that 70% of Americans, including a majority of Republicans, now favor implementing Medicare for all. Then finally, we'll speak with an expert on white-collar crime, Henry Pontell, distinguished professor of sociology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and author of Profit Without Honor, White-Collar Crime and the Looting of America. He joins us to discuss how Trump fits a pattern of rich, powerful people who begin to believe their own reality and start feeling they can get away with lying and cheating because their wealth and status protects them. And while Trump has been documented uttering 6,500 lies since he has been in office, Henry Pontell argues Trump's illusion of his immunity to truth and consequences is unparalleled. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is David Carroll, a professor of media design at the New School and director of its Design and Technology MFA program, where he explores the intersection between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. And his research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Carroll.
Thanks for having me.
And David, the Washington Post have obtained a report put together by the Senate Intelligence Committee led by Senator Richard Byrd, Republican, North Carolina chairman, and Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, the ranking Democrat. The first report is by Oxford University's Computational Propaganda Project and Graphica, which is a network analysis firm. And the second report is prepared for the Senate Intelligence Committee by researchers for New Knowledge, another one of these internet analysis firms, Columbia University and Canfield Research. So have you had a chance to look at either or both of these reports?
I have spent most of the time working through the New Knowledge report, which is definitely significant in its findings, yes.
And the other report, I think, is going to be released later. But let's deal with the one that you've looked at, New Knowledge. What does it tell us that we don't already know? And is this Russian interference bigger than was previously thought? Because, you know, some people have suggested that it's been exaggerated.
The New Knowledge Report is very important and essential reading. The researchers behind it are very well respected and have been on the leading edge of these discussions and have developed really significant forensic techniques. So anyone who looks through it, they'll realize it's very evidence-based and very clearly organized. It has some really troubling findings. One of the primary ones is that it makes a very strong case that the tech platforms provided the absolute bare minimum data required to analyze the problem to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And the report details some of the data that these platforms have that they have not shared that could give us even greater understanding of the influence operation, its scope and scale. It also shows that how Facebook's initial statement that it was just $100,000 worth of ads was sort of created this narrative that it was no big deal and fueled skepticism that it could be an effective mechanism to influence Americans. But the report shows that the scope and scale is far larger than that sort of initial figure would indicate, and it crossed many platforms and was sophisticated in its methodologies to target different kinds of Americans across the spectrum and to, in a sense, leverage them as assets, in some cases even collecting information about them to compromise them, deeply infiltrating activist groups, and really changing behaviors. And these behaviors are measurable in both how the information was spread organically, but also how behaviors changed. People went to events, people purchased things. There's a variety of ways. And lastly, the other big thing that the New Knowledge Report zeroes in on is that the African-American community in the United States was particularly deeply sort of attacked by this effort. That's a narrative that hasn't really gotten enough attention. And in terms of a voter suppression and voter depression concept, that's very troubling to go through in the report.
Well, indeed, the Russians appear to have targeted both the right wing and the left wing. And it seemed that more than anything, they were focused on hurting Hillary Clinton rather than electing Trump, although clearly they were promoting Trump. But for right-wing people that they were trying to influence, you know, there's an awful lot of evidence of what they were promoting here. But for the left-wing audience, they seemed to, particularly African-Americans, liberals, they were basically saying that you either vote for Jill Stein of the Green Party or stay at home. And I'm glad you clarified what I meant by certain people have played it down, the impact of the Russian interference, and most of them have been the big tech giants themselves, who both reports, I take it, are very critical of.
Yes, I mean, what is really troubling to me is that, you know, this whole debate about whether Facebook sells our data or not is a debate that clouds what they really sell, which is conversion data. That is, an advertiser sells the success of the campaign, whether or not you got your targets to perform the behaviors and actions that you hope they would, subscribe to things, buy things, and so on. And these conversion pathways, the New Knowledge Report highlights, have still to this day not been shared. And this would, you know, allow us to understand precisely how many Americans changed their behaviors because of a Putin-ordered influence operation. And the platforms clearly have this information because it's what they sell their customers, the advertisers.
And again, I'm speaking with David Carroll, who's a professor of media design at the New School and director of his design and technology MFA program, where he explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. And his research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. We're talking about the Senate Intelligence Committee's two reports that they commissioned, which the Washington Post have obtained a copy of. I believe the full reports will be out in the next couple of days. But just in terms of the pages that the Russians put together with Facebook pages, which are controlled by the Internet Research Agency, the troll farm in St. Petersburg run by Putin's chef, the so-called cook, Yevgeny Prigozhin. My understanding is, David, that you know, you've got sort of all these young hackers and others, people that the Russians hire, sitting in this long sort of room against computer terminals, and they're encouraged to look at American TV series like House of Cards to get the latest vernacular right so that they can do these Facebook pages with titles such as Being Patriotic. Obviously, that's for the right-wing Americans, Heart of Texas for the right-wing Americans, Blacktivist for the left-wing Americans, and Army of Jesus for the right-wing Americans. But just to give some statistics that come out of these new reports, the 20 most popular pages generated by the Russians got 39 million likes, 31 million shares, 5.4 million reactions, and 3.4 million comments. And the group that we're talking about who did this analysis found that the Russian campaign reached 126 million people on Facebook and 20 million more on Instagram. So that seems like a pretty deep penetration of our democratic system and our election.
The report does a very good job of illustrating how fomenting tribalism was a primary tactic to foment division, that we are not one America, but we are many Americas working against each other, is the key theme across all of the topics. So in terms of the high-level strategy of the agency, it was to use targeting and group segmentation against us to create in-group and out-group perceptions. And when you look at the examples of the effort, you can see how explicit that was. And there was also a very overt use of what's called meme warfare. Memetics is something that the DARPA agency of the Department of Defense has researched for many years. It is a known sort of military psychological operations tactic. A meme is really a simple image with text, and it has a kind of genetic property to it. It wants to propagate itself, and it wants to mutate, and it wants people to adapt them and make their own. And so meme culture is a sort of new development that thrives on the internet, and particularly image-based social platforms such as Instagram and Tumblr. And the reports do a very good job of re-emphasizing the role of Instagram as a kind of initial attack vector, using these meme images to disseminate propaganda and to then spread the ideas across the platforms. So I think this is one thing that when we go back and remember how Facebook presented itself to Congress, Instagram was not a topic that was discovered very much, was not discussed very much, but when we look at the statistics, it was potentially a more significant platform than Facebook in certain ways. But again, it was a cross-platform effort, and we really need to think about this idea of meme warfare as part of the overall operation.
Well, Instagram, of course, is owned by Facebook, and YouTube is owned by Google, and so all three seem to be the favorite vehicles. But does that mean, David Carroll, that these new platforms, which were developed here in the United States and have been used against us by the Russians, that the platforms themselves are the problem?
I mean, at this stage, we need to figure out how these platforms can be held accountable. The report, you know, makes some strong assertions that Congress may have been misled, whether intentionally or not. So we need to sort of get to the bottom of the honesty or deception that these platforms have made in terms of their own effort to protect themselves as opposed to be accountable. So this is a concern that we should have. How accountable are these platforms to the nation rather than their own bottom line or their own public relations policies? And then in terms of moving forward, how can we educate the population to be more wary of these attacks because they will continue. And how can we create a sort of what is called in some circles a kind of cognitive security? That is, we will not allow ourselves to be manipulated, and we will not allow ourselves to be divided into these tribes. How can we create national unity when we are in an environment that is highly personalized, highly targeted, and constantly trying to group us into segments for the purposes of advertising? So it's an unintended consequence of advertising technology, which was designed to group us into our consumer segmentations so that we can be advertised appropriate products that are relevant to us. That same technology was used by our adversaries to divide us into hostile tribes. And I think we need to have a deep look at whether ad targeting is more important than national unity.
So this new knowledge report that you've studied, David Carroll, apparently was based on analysis of 10 million tweets, 116,000 Instagram posts, and 61,500 Facebook posts sent by this Russian government-linked troll group, the Internet Research Agency, owned by Yevgeny Prigozhin, who is referred to as Putin's chef or Putin's cook. He also has a mercenary army that he also owns. But this same IRA, the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, was targeted by Robert Mueller, and several of the top people there were indicted last February by Robert Mueller. So is that the only outlet? It seems like the Russians operated on so many different fronts. You know, they had this redhead Butina looking into the co-opting the NRA, the National Rifle Association, in order to probably funnel, wash Russian money that went into Trump and the campaign via the NRA. And on all sorts of fronts, they had other operations going. So is the IRA the only one? I mean, if this report's pretty bad, but they've only identified one particular actor there, the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, it's troubling to consider that Russia is not the only nation conducting influence operations on us. There's been evidence disclosed that the state of Iran is also. There's been reports that China has attempted. So we need to be wary of this across sort of global policy. And then we also need to be wary of, you know, how this interfaces with even domestic campaigns. So there haven't been any indictments yet, but we do know that because of Rick Gates being one of the indicted suspects, that he asked for a pitch from a company called Psy Group, which has since shuttered, based out of Israel, which had pitched the Trump campaign for tactics that basically resemble what the Internet Research Agency did, which is create fake news, establish false social media accounts to disseminate and amplify disinformation and to manipulate reality as a service to campaigns. So we not only need to worry about this from international actors using our own commercial infrastructure against us, but unfortunately we also need to worry about politics and their campaigns being pitched these services.
Well, it's pretty obvious that this worked for Trump, did it not? And Cambridge Analytica got a lot of credit, and maybe a lot of it perhaps was exaggerated, but the long and the short of it was, it did seem that the Trump campaign really understood the power of social media much more recently than Hillary Clinton did. She ran an old-fashioned campaign of spending an awful lot of money on television advertising, where it looks as if the Trump campaign got more bang for the buck going via using Facebook, where we learned that 2/3 of Americans get their news and information from in the first place.
And indeed, any campaign that seeks to divide rather than unite is going to enjoy success on social media platforms because they are designed to do that. They are designed to sort us into categories and amplify our affinities to people like us. And indeed, the engagement algorithms reward content that is divisive, incendiary, you know, creates an emotional reaction. The sort of whole system is biased toward a sort of divisive, tribalist experience. And it wasn't really designed to suppress that kind of reaction, because most of these algorithms and systems reward engagement above all else and have no preference for healthy engagement, just engagement. So in case of YouTube, it's just watch time. The more you watch, the more they make. In terms of Facebook, likes and shares, so it's sort of the mechanisms of the platforms are agnostic to the content, and so therefore potentially negative, divisive content is always going to win out over content that will not make us emotional but might be more healthy for us as a society.
So since the Russians focused on activating conservatives to vote with their messages about gun rights and immigration, and on the left, they targeted African-American voters to undermine their faith in the elections and turn them against Hillary Clinton. They also went after Latinos, Muslims, Christians, gay men and women, liberals and Southerners, and veterans. So all of the above will probably happen in 2020, both on this side and from the Russians. But just in closing, Mark Zuckerberg met in Moscow at the president's residence with then-President Dmitry Medvedev, where Zuckerberg on camera gave Medvedev a Facebook T-shirt, and it was all very friendly. So what do you think went on back then? I mean, I'm not suggesting that there was any complicity between the Russians and Facebook, but it seems as if the Russians figured out early, you know, we're talking about 2012, that this is a great propaganda tool that they can turn against us.
I mean, I think the important issue is that Facebook is the most powerful entity in the world from certain perspectives. In certain nations in the world, Facebook is the internet. And so the question is how can Facebook be loyal to United States when it has operations around the world? It is a truly global infrastructure to the world, and this is definitely Zuckerberg's grand vision, to be the entity that connects the world. So ultimately, it's a conflict between the mission to connect the world and also, you know, have a duty and loyalty to the United States when its adversaries are also on the platform and investors and money and interests are all interconnected.
Right. Well, we all celebrated the use of social media in the Arab Spring, particularly in Tahrir Square in Egypt. But then we got a cold shower from the 2016 election when realizing how there's a dark side of social media, which could be used against us, not to liberate people, but to manipulate them against their interests. I thank you for joining us, David Carroll.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Carroll. He's a professor of media design at the New School and director of his design and technology MFA program, where he explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. And his research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether the latest effort to kill the Affordable Care Act by a U.S. federal district judge in Texas is why a recent poll found that 70% of Americans, including a majority of Republicans, now favor implementing Medicare for All.
We don't care.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Egan Kemp, who's a healthcare policy advocate at Public Citizen, who focuses on single-payer systems, private health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, the Veterans Health Administration, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, working on social determinants of health, mental health, and drug shortages. Welcome to Background Briefing, Egan Kemp.
Thanks so much for having me.
And on Friday night, just before the Saturday deadline to enroll for 2019 for coverage under the Affordable Care Act, a Texas U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor ruled the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. This led President Trump to celebrate, saying, wow, Obamacare was just ruled unconstitutional by a highly respected judge in Texas. Great news for America. My question would be twofold. Why is it great news to take away health care from 20 million Americans? And why in the law is it more important on some technical grounds, because this suit was brought by a coalition of Republican state officials, why deny health care for some legal technicality? What is the priority there? So I know you're not a lawyer, but if you wouldn't mind answering at least the political question first and then try and deal with what kind of person would celebrate taking health care away from 20 million people, and that person happens to be the president. And the other question would be, what kind of lawyer are you to celebrate the idea that taking away health care is some great service to humanity?
Definitely. No, those are the right questions to be asking. And also sort of around the timing, it's obviously absurd that overturning a law that expanded care to so many Americans, it expanded care access to care that was affordable to so many Americans, often for the first time, or allowed them to stay on their parents' insurance. To say that overturn of that is great, especially when Republicans don't have any other idea. I mean, as they showed through 2017 and 2018, if they had an idea, they had all the time in the world when they were in control of both houses of Congress as well as the presidency to try to implement that. And, you know, one of the things about the ACA is that, you know, it was implemented in Massachusetts first based on a number of Republican ideas. So it was sort of a bipartisan approach. Now, in terms of the legal, sort of the technicality there, I mean, this was an example of, you know, how Trump's sabotage efforts allowed them to do further sabotage efforts. So they undermined the Affordable Care Act by getting rid of the tax penalty for the individual mandate in their tax scam bill late last year. And so just 1 year past that, this court was able to overturn the entire Affordable Care Act. Obviously, that's going to be appealed up to the Supreme Court, and there's going to be a big fight there. But that the sabotage they undertook there allowed them to further sabotage the law through the courts.
Well, we know that Trump's been sabotaging it all along, and they found all kinds of administrative ways to limit the ability of the Affordable Care Act to work in terms of getting more people enrolled, because the idea is to, you know, with insurance, the bigger the pool, the better the and the stronger the system. And, for example, they stopped the budget for advertising the sign-up period. And, of course, this judge came down just on the eve of the deadline to sign up. Clearly, that's more than a coincidence. So explain that.
No, not a coincidence at all.
Right, but explain this.
It definitely was an opportunity for them to you know, sort of almost take a victory lap, saying, you know, now we've dismantled it fully. And as you point out, they've taken so many administrative steps allowing the sale of junk plans, whether short-term health plans or association health plans, that to a lot of consumers look cheaper, but then if they get sick while they're on those plans, they will find themselves on the hook for a variety of fees that they wouldn't through an ACA plan that includes a lot more protections. And the fact that they continue to go back to that well of weakening the ACA, and then even pushing for it to be completely overhauled without an alternative is just really immoral.
But I know you're not a lawyer, but what is this? When you talked about how step one was to rule the individual mandate unconstitutional, and then step two by this Texas district U.S. district judge was to throw out the whole Affordable Care Act, what's the legal standing there? I don't understand. I understand that what the motive is sabotage,
right?
But I don't understand how somehow it's a violation of the Constitution to give people health care.
Right. Yeah, so their logic here is that, you know, by getting rid of the tax penalty, all of a sudden there's the individual mandate doesn't actually exist. While it's still in the law, the tax scam bill only took away sort of the punishment. The punishment was sort of the key part of the individual mandate, that if somebody didn't have health insurance, they would have to pay a small fee or get an exemption if they, you know, for hardship reasons. And so by getting that away, this judge made sort of the leap that, well, without that, none of the ACA can exist, that if you don't have that sort of enforcement mechanism of the tax penalty from the individual mandate, none of it counts. Now, there's a number of legal scholars out there that say that that's absurd, and, you know, a number of courts have found sort of, you know, the ACA constitutional on a variety of grounds. And so, you know, Javier Becerra, the Attorney General of the state of California, has already, you know, identified that he and other states will be appealing this all the way to the Supreme Court, because it's just not sort of legally sound. I mean, that was sort of his logic, but most people think that's a pretty flimsy case for undermining the health care of over 20 million people.
So President Obama seems to have tried to reassure people that as bad as this looks, it may not be quite that bad. He said this thing can be a scary thing to hear, particularly if you or someone you care about has a pre-existing condition. And that's why it's so important for you to know that last night's ruling changes nothing for now. As this decision makes its way through the courts, which will take months if not years, the law remains in place and will likely stay that way. So Right. That's a reassurance. Are you comforted by that?
I think it is important to reassure people and to make sure that people know that the ACA is still the law of the land, so that people are still applying. You know, in some states it hasn't closed yet, so in states where the ACA marketplaces are still open, you know, people can still be applying for coverage, and that people know that, you know, if they lose their job or their status changes, they can still get sort of a special exemption to get on the ACA marketplaces. So it's important for people to know that they do still exist and that they do have access to care. But it doesn't give me a lot of hope, just based on the level of sabotage that the Trump administration has done. Even if it's not overturned at the Supreme Court, they've really undermined sort of the core pieces of the ACA and makes it a lot harder for insurance companies to decide to stay, and it also makes it a lot harder for them to keep the prices down. So the Trump sabotage alone is already costing Americans money, regardless of whether the ACA is able to stay in the long run or not.
So let's talk about the idea that this Republican sabotage, and apparently the Republicans in Congress are not thrilled with this ruling and with Trump's cheering it, because they think they discovered in the last election that issues about pre-existing conditions were really resonated with people, and they got an earful from their constituents. So that seems to be one of the strongest issues that Democrats can run on. So does this situation with Trump and the sabotage by the Republicans or the Affordable Care Act, do you think it's heading us in the direction of Medicare for All? Because there was a recent poll that had 70% of Americans and even a majority of Republicans favoring the implementation of Medicare for All.
Yeah, it seems like a very exciting time to be talking about the next steps for healthcare, that so many Americans are seeing the flaws of our current system, and the Republicans in Congress have only emphasized them by undermining the ACA. I mean, as everyone knew, and sort of any healthcare reform, nothing's ever going to be perfect, but we're always going to be able to make changes and make improvements. And right now we're seeing so many Americans frustrated and struggling, having a hard time keeping up with their drug costs, having a hard time, you know, covering medical debt that they may have to take on, and sometimes even for surprise bills. They thought they were in network and they ended up not being in network. And all those things pile on so that Americans are like, this is not the healthcare system that the wealthiest country in the world should have. And so people are looking for that next step, and a lot of folks are finding it in Medicare for All, that taking the, you know, most successful, one of the longest running healthcare programs in the U.S., improving it and then expanding it to all Americans. It really would give a chance to a lot of folks to finally have access to the healthcare they need and to improve their health in the long run.
So how are we going to get from A to B?
Well, that's the important part. And we're starting to see, and I think that's why Republicans are so scared, is in 2017 and 2018, they had so many opportunities to put forward plans, and they never did. But throughout that whole time, Public Citizen and a number of other groups were working together to say, well, we see an answer. We see an answer in Medicare for All. And so the way that you do that now is we're seeing it both sort of at the state level and at the federal level. We're seeing exciting proposals in both the House and the Senate, and then in a variety of states, people pushing for single-payer Medicare for All and really putting their money where their mouth is, putting folks out in the field, people running on it. We had a record number of people running on Medicare for All in the 2016 election. So there's a groundswell. I mean, I get calls every day from our members asking what they can do next. People are fired up, and they're ready to push for a better healthcare system.
So do you think that one or more of the Democratic candidates running for president in 2020 will get behind Medicare for All?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we've already seen a number of folks from Cory Booker to Elizabeth Warren to Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, a variety of folks, signing on to Medicare for All and discussing Medicare for All. And even some of the folks that aren't necessarily there on Medicare for All yet, haven't signed on to the bills, are still talking about the importance of coverage for everyone. I mean, you even had Republicans in the midterm elections talking about pre-existing conditions and talking about their families' health care experiences. And the fact that we're getting so many Americans highlighting the challenges they've had in the health care system, and presidential candidates are listening to that. And so you're going to have it throughout sort of the primaries, health care, both Republican and Democrat primaries, health care is going to be a crucial issue. And right now, only the Democrats have a strong message. And the strongest message out there is on Medicare for All.
So do you think then, I don't understand the motives, as I've made clear in these questions to you. I don't understand how this is legally justified, and it's certainly not morally justified. And I don't understand even the politics of it. I don't think they're not going to work for Trump or the Republicans. And it's almost as if Trump's sadistic in a way. I mean, anything that Obama did, he has to destroy. And 20 million Americans are collateral damage. It's just breathtaking.
It does seem that way. It does seem, we've had bills that have passed in the, previously that, one side was more behind or the other, or one side didn't like. But the ACA represents, such an absurd turn in our politics that so many Americans were helped by it, but Republicans refused to engage. Democrats even from the beginning said, when we pass this, we're going to need to go in and make tweaks over time to improve it, to address, any unexpected consequences. But they've been unable to do that because Republicans have only said, nope, it's got to be repeal. For the longest time, it was just repeal. Eventually, they started talking about repeal and replace, but their replacements were just a shadow of the current system. And the current system, as we've talked about, is full of all sorts of problems. So the fact that they couldn't even come up with something, some alternative, and I think that sort of goes back to that, a number of the things in the ACA, including sort of some of the least popular parts, like the individual mandate, they came out of the Heritage Foundation and other conservative groups and was, tried out by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts. And so it ends up being, these Republican ideas ended up being taken up by a Democratic president, which should have led to bipartisan support, but didn't. And then you've got Republicans unwilling to engage in any way except repeal.
Well, Egan Kemp, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Egan Kemp, who's a healthcare policy advocate at Public Citizen, who focuses on single-payer systems, private health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, the Veterans Health Administration, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, working on social determinants of health, mental health, and drug shortages. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with an expert on white-collar crime about how much Trump fits a pattern of rich, powerful people who begin to believe their own reality and start feeling they can get away with lying and cheating because their wealth and status protects them.
Oh,
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henry Pontell, who's a distinguished professor of sociology at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, the former president of the White Collar Crime Research Consortium of the National White Collar Crime Center. His books include International Handbook of White Collar and Corporate Crime, Profit Without Honor, White Collar Crime and the Looting of America, and Big Money Crime, Fraud and Politics in the Savings and Loan Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Pontell.
Thank you very much, Ian. Nice to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. And there's an article at the Los Angeles Times: after nearly 2 years in the White House, Trump lies start catching up with him, by Chris McGarry and Eli Stokels. And you're quoted in this article basically saying, a lot of white collar criminals have an illusion of invulnerability, especially high status individuals who have a feeling that they aren't going to be touched by the law. Because their status and wealth protects them, this illusion of invulnerability may be exacerbated to the point that the lying continues all the way up until the lights go out. But Trump's illusion of invulnerability is unparalleled to anything I've ever seen. So I guess 6,500 lies have been documented so far. When do you think the lies are going to catch up with him?
That's a good question. That's the political question. The legal question is another question, and that's Mueller's investigation and what the Southern District of New York is doing. So basically, I think that the walls, you know, clearly, it's, as it's been reported, the walls are closing in. And as they do, Trump acts more erratically, as do his apostles who are there speaking with him or for him, including people like Rudy Giuliani, who is not speaking anymore really from a legal standpoint, but more or less from a political one. So Trump is playing the political game and hanging in as long as he can, as far as I can say. The Mueller investigation, I think it's important to note that the Mueller investigation also has so much corroborating evidence that all this talk about Michael Cohen being a liar, et cetera, is just, it's fluff at this point, because the raid on Cohen's office has produced a virtual treasure trove of solid evidence that's going to be used in bringing about the Russian report. So I'd say it's looking very bad, and that the lies are catching up with the president. He's changing his positions almost daily on things, and this is very, very serious.
But from the point of view of a sociologist, you're a distinguished professor of sociology at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Henry Pontell, explore with us, if you will, the pathology of wealthy people developing a sense of impunity.
All right. Well, you know, this comes from case studies that have been done over the years. The savings and loan crisis produced one infamous character, the virtual poster boy of the savings and loan crisis, Charles Keating, who did, you know, I guess things you could say would be similar to what Trump is doing in terms of attacking the attackers, or as criminologists would say, condemning the condemners. This is not only a tactic of white-collar criminals, but also of common criminals. Charles Keating had an illusion of invulnerability based on the fact that, he was of very high status. He had very, very strong connections to high-level politicians, in this case the presidents, Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan. And, you know, when he was caught red-handed, and again, it's the solid evidence that brings these folks to telling the truth eventually, if they can, or they're forced to. The issue with Keating was, you know, just an incredible illusion of invulnerability there. He was very, very powerful, and again, had very powerful connections. And that was one case, the savings and loan case that stood out, and he was brought to justice. His case was overturned on a legal technicality, but he served, I think it was 7 years in prison before that actually occurred. You have another case, Martha Stewart was another example that I talked about and written about. Martha Stewart, again, a very, very powerful defendant, wealthy defendant. And again, she was convicted of lying to federal investigators. She was being indicted for allegedly engaging in insider trading, for which her colleague, Sam Waxall, served time for, but she never admitted to it, never was even tried for it. She had, I guess, again, the illusion of invulnerability there, that the federal investigators couldn't touch her, given her expertise and her knowledge and her sense of being able to outdo the investigators. She lied to investigators, and that's what she was convicted of. The entire scheme that she was involved in never had to be proven in order to send her to prison and then into home confinement. Another example would be Michael Milken, who came back and resurrected himself again as a successful financial person. He has been very charitable with his wealth, but at the time of his conviction, he saw himself as a misunderstood visionary. That, you know, he was above it all. He was beyond what the feds knew about junk bonds and such. And so you have case after case where not every single white collar criminal is going to be have this illusion to that extent, but many of them do, especially the more powerful ones, because they do have lives that are very different than the rest of us in terms of things that they have to deal with day to day, and the amount of protection that they have in terms of others who serve them and their protected statuses.
So in the case of Charles Keating, of course, he gave a lot of money to charity and was prominent as a sort of philanthropist, even while he was defrauding widows out of their homes. And Martha Stewart, of course, being a media figure herself, knew how to use the media. Trump has that advantage as well, does he not? Being media savvy, being a former reality TV guy. So how much is Trump's use of the media? I mean, he was schooled in cutting corners by his attorney, Roy Cohn, who represented the two mafia families in New York, the Genoveses and the Lucchese's. But on the other hand, he seems to have an added skill with his use of the media.
Yeah, I think that's true. And in fact, if you look at his rise to the presidency, he virtually squeezed Hillary Clinton off of the airwaves. He was taking up so much time. But, you know, and I guess the principle that he lives by, that any news is good news. And I think that's, even if it's bad news, it's keeping you in the spotlight. And I think, you know, there's been a run of Trump stories for the last two or three years that have been unprecedented in terms of, you know, some of the craziness of the stories, the outlandishness of the stories. And whether that or not that's a strategy, clearly it could be. But, you know, you're right. He is very media savvy, and it seems to work to his advantage because he kind of takes up our attention. I'd add to that, though, that a lot of these things that we see in the media, and if he is media savvy, and I think he is, a lot of the things that I think take place are really, at this point, diversions or misdirections. And, you know, they think the media's already reported on this. You know, look at this glittering object, and he distracts people. And while things are getting hot on one story, he moves it, shifts it to another. So in that sense, maybe it's media savvy. But I think at some point, and I think the media is caught between a rock and a hard place here, that they kind of know what's going on, but they have to stay essentially neutral in terms of reporting it. Otherwise, they look biased and they prove his point, which is that the media is out to get him. And so it's a very difficult situation. But I think at some point, these lies and the fact that the media has done such an incredible job of documentation, and we have videotape and we have recording, that when he says something which is diametrically opposed to what was said earlier, they can put that out there and let the people see it. And I think that's what's going to start changing things. The Republicans in Congress, I think, are just as guilty, if you will, as Trump in terms of enabling this kind of behavior. And it's really unprecedented.
I mentioned Roy Cohn as Trump's mentor and lawyer who represented mobsters. On Sunday, Trump talked about his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, who he's denying even knowing, the famous fixer who said he'd take a bullet for Trump. He characterized Cohen as a rat for testifying against him and, of course, claimed that the FBI had broken into Cohen's law offices when, in fact, they were operating on a a legal warrant from a judge, which has prompted Senator Chris Coons to say that we have a mob boss in the Oval Office. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it brings to mind movies like Goodfellas and the organized criminals. But what I make of it is that it's literally a way to play the game, and it's really not. He might convince people that that's the case, but the FBI doesn't illegally break into anything. They have court orders which they have to show evidence for beforehand, enough evidence that a judge allows them to basically raid an office. A raid is not a break-in. I mean, it's very, you know, the Watergate was a break-in. This was a legal raid, and so, you know, the way that things are characterized and pushed around and lies are told and half-truths, it's just it's not perplexing in the sense that this is, again, another part of the distraction. It's basically getting people to focus and to fight about these other issues, which really aren't arguable. And I think that's where this is going to come back to when we started our conversation, you know, that the lies are going to catch up to them because the law doesn't consider those silly things. I mean, those things are silly, and you can say them, and sure, maybe you can get away with them for at some point in time, but after a while, the law will catch up. And I think the biggest danger here, and thing I don't think that anyone's seen in our lifetimes, is that, you know, the very legitimacy of the rule of law, the very legitimacy of the FBI and the Department of Justice, the legitimacy of our norms and institutions are being called into question. And if those institutions fall, or if they're infiltrated by these lies, then all bets are off. And so I really do think it's a race against time, that we have to somehow get to the truth. And Mueller's got to finish that report to see exactly what was going on before there's no chance to do so.
Well, a lot of people think that the laws have already been undermined in law enforcement. The FBI, the Justice Department have been politicized. And it's pretty extraordinary that Trump still has 30% of the population who, you have to admit that Fox News plays a huge role, Rupert Murdoch, in keeping people in a bubble of delusion where they're immune to facts and evidence, as the president himself is, and they are able to characterize all of the work that the rest of the media is doing to expose the truth as fake news.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable when you think about it. But I think that 30% or whatever, that solid core is of 20%, they're never going to let go. And so I don't think it needs to go to zero. I think it just needs to go to a reasonable number where the Republicans see that they're never going to be reelected again, and that they've essentially, in this case, I'd say, created a Frankenstein monster, and now they have to live with it. Now they have to deal with controlling it. And there's really not much else to be said other than the country has to deal with this. And so this is what's going on. And hopefully we will see the end of it rather soon, one way or the other. And my prediction, of course, would be that Mueller does have the evidence that Cohen is not lying, that there's the evidence from a raid where they had, I think it was a million documents or more from, in terms of tapes and messaging and texts and all kinds of things from Cohen's office. We'll show the truth. And let's not also forget that Cohen worked for him for 10 years. So if he's a rat and a liar, this was the president's lawyer for 10 years.
Right, and it's not just...
Weissenberg, who's already cut a deal, has worked with the Trump family 40 years.
Right.
So this isn't just something which happened during a campaign and a presidency. This goes back.
Right.
And so I would expect there to be other things they find as well.
Well, I was about to say that he's also buttressed by the bookkeeper, Weissenberg. But just in closing, when Trump came onto the scene, I did my homework by talking to businessmen who had interacted with him in New York. And there was a consistent theme. They all said, some of them said, I couldn't wait to get out of the meeting. They thought the guy was an egomaniac and living in his own world. And so this is a condition that's been apparently going on for some time with Trump. And my sense is that he probably didn't even want this job. He really, I think, ran for president to improve the brand, not thinking he would get as far as he did, but knowing that he would put out the Trump brand and create a constituency of support.
Yes.
Do you think that's the case? Because he didn't have a victory speech prepared on election night. His wife was in tears. I get a feeling that this man has been hoisted on his own petard of vanity.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I would certainly think that's a good possibility. I would agree basically with what you just said about him not expecting to be president, and nor was he prepared for this. Nor was he. I think he, the type of person. And it's been shown, I guess, over the last couple of years, and I think it will be shown in the future, that he's not the kind of person that should be holding this position. So, I don't feel sorry for the family or for him for doing this. It's really quite sad that the president really is someone that wasn't expecting to be president. And I think that's absolutely true. He was totally unprepared for it. His behaviors and pointing of his family to these positions and not being really able to get much done other than to rile up his base during the last couple of years and basically alienate and anger as many people as he can instead of bringing the country together. I think that's all indicative of someone who is fully unprepared to be president. And another way to think about it is, why would someone in his position even want this job other than, as you say, for self-benefit or to improve the brand? And I think, running was the big thing, not winning. So this is all coming to roost at this point. You have someone who, again, I don't know if I want to say likely, but possibly has things in his past which he doesn't want shown for reasons of self-preservation. So now he's in the spotlight, the same with Manafort. If Manafort hadn't gone in and become his campaign manager, Manafort might be committing the same crimes that he's already been convicted of, and no one would have known the difference.
Sure.
And that's how much white-collar crime just keeps, takes place. I think Manafort, people put themselves in these positions where they come under the spotlight.
Right.
And I think that's what's happening here.
Well, just in the last minute, the IRS budget's been slashed over the last 8 years. And has that benefited white-collar criminals? Because there is a disparity here. A new report from ProPublica says that a person who claims the earned income tax credit, whose average income is less than $20,000 a year, are far more likely to be audited by the IRS than someone making 100 times that.
Yes, absolutely. It's benefited white-collar criminals in the sense that these crimes, and as we see with what's going on with the presidency, although there are much far less complex types of crimes, they're very costly to investigate, audit, et cetera. So, of course, the IRS, when they've been strapped and cut, just as all regulatory agencies have been, they are going to be less able to go after the bigger fish. And that's what we're seeing with the IRS, and I think that's what we're going to be seeing or finding out soon enough about with our regulatory agencies as well.
Well, Henry Pontella, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. Pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Henry Pontell, who is a distinguished professor of sociology at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, the former president of the White Collar Crime Research Consortium of the National White Collar Crime Center. His books include International Handbook of White Collar and Corporate Crime, Profit Without Honor, White Collar Crime and the Looting of America, and Big Money Crime, Fraud and Politics in the Savings and Loan Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.